Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that on the eve of that event, the United States government, aided and abetted, by the way, by the New York Times, the United States government committed the most provocative acts, practically, that could have been done. Provocative acts which could very easily have led to an explosion in New Haven, the kind of senseless rampage of violence that would not have focused on the objective and would not have advanced the movement. The provocative acts were, of course, for one, the invasion of Cambodia and the bombing of North Vietnam, but secondly, the announcement on the very day when they should have been saying that the New Haven charges were being dropped, the announcement that a similar case was being dredged up and manufactured in Baltimore. But the people who were there discussed, analyzed, and responded to those provocations maturely under the leadership and with the assistance of the Black Panther Party. And they did not allow themselves to be diverted from a continuing campaign of support and activity into the kind of scene that the National Guard, and I believe that General Mitchell, by the way, don't ever have any mistakes, General Mitchell is more dangerous than his wife. The kind of unfocused, senseless violence that they would like to have put down. In the same way, in Washington, we're going to Washington with the spirit of New Haven behind us. We're going there as a movement that is not going down there to give some people the emotional satisfaction of trashing some windows or having fun and games with the police. I mean, I talked to somebody yesterday who said, I've done my share of street fighting. And you know, you sort of get a thrill out of it. They come on down one street and you go down another street and then you come back and you manage to break some windows and you manage to get away from the gas and you manage to throw some rocks and everything. But after what happened in Kent, Ohio, the people that I know, he said, are no longer in the mood for that kind of thing. We can't fool around. And I think that we're going to Washington in the knowledge that we have a weapon more powerful than random trashing and the temporary excitement of relatively unsuccessful and unpurposeful fighting with the police. We're going there. We're going there with the knowledge that if you're serious about trying to save the lives of future Kent students so that they will not have died in vain, saving the lives and the independence of the Vietnamese and the Cambodians and the Laotians and the Thais and all of the rest of the people who were victimized by American imperialism, if you're serious about saving the lives of the GIs, who thank God in the last few years people recognize are our allies and our brothers rather than our enemies. If you're going there with that kind of a serious determination and with the lift and the energy already evident, already created by the coordinated student strike, then you're going there not to be sidetracked and not to be deflected, but in order to announce and make real and make plans for and work together with other people to paralyze the war machine and to force an end to the aggression against the black community and the aggression against Cambodia. Now, I'd just like to underline that by one statement from our recent trial in Chicago.
WBAI, New York.
Night before last, I guess it was, I lose track, or night before last with Abby Hoffman. And 10,000 people showed up. One of the reasons was the same reason that brings you people here today. But another reason was because the state of New Hampshire had decided to ban our appearance. And at 7 o'clock, we thought if we spoke at 7:30, that was going to be the end as far as our bail and a lot of other things were concerned. But we decided that the principle of the thing and the energy and the drive of the movement was too important. And so we decided to speak anyway. But because of all the publicity and the threats and everything, 10,000 people were there. So Abby started out by saying, "Recently I've been involved in a little trial out in the Midwest. Did you hear about it?" Well, they decided to make ours a show trial, and we helped them. We were willing to and anxious to have that happen, too. But don't ever forget that while that was a show trial, we got favored treatment, bad as it was. And you don't forget the routine trials, the routine repression, which was going down on other people in other cases all the time. If I had time, I'd tell you about some of them, like the Seattle Eight, who've been indicted on the same charge out of a demonstration in Seattle, Washington. And again, instead of picking people who they might have thought threw a brick through a window or something, they picked eight people who they consider the leaders of that movement in order to put a quash on it. And when I talked to the New York Press about that, who turned out about something else, I said, "How come you haven't printed a word about that?" And they said, "Well, that's not news anymore." But anyway, to go back to our trial, which was better known, but simply, you know, as an example of all the others that and the no trials sometimes, but the same aim being carried out by the government. There were times during that trial when I'm sure most of the defendants were tempted to stand up and throw a chair. There were times when people whom I respect and love said to me that what was happening there was so atrocious and it was so impossible to get any kind of justice that the best thing that would happen would be if somebody would shoot the judge. Well, the fact is that I think if anybody, us or any of our supporters or anybody else, had succumbed to that temptation, instead of responding politically to the trial and the courtroom, and the way the press distorted it may not have seemed all that political or all that reasoned, but believe me, we were not just arbitrarily, anytime we felt like it, standing up and screaming. When things happened that were wrong, we tried to put the finger on them, and we tried not to be sheep going to the slaughter. But it was a political response. And I believe that if we had succumbed to the temptation to throw a chair or attack the judge or something else, we would have done less than we did to undermine the system that the judge was defending, undermine the system that Attorney General Mitchell was defending when he decided to indict us, undermine the system of imperialism and aggression and racism and economic injustice which Richard Nixon was defending when he gave the signal, yes, they should proceed with the indictments and the trial. And that's my approach to Washington this weekend. There are times when it's going to be hard not to pick up a rock. There are times when it's going to be hard not to turn it into street fighting, purposeless or purposeful, as the case may seem to you. And if the strikes were not in process, and if there were not a possibility of turning May 1970 in the United States into a May 1968 in Paris, only going on more successfully at the end of it than they did, if that were not a possibility, then I might be too timid, if that's the word, or too confused to stand up here and say, don't go to Washington to engage in street fighting or throwing bricks or what have you. But the fact is, we do have something moving which must not be deflected, must not be confused, and that's why I think we must go there. Clear that we're laying siege to the White House and we're not going to petition the president. That would be immoral and politically irrelevant to petition the president at this time. We're going, as I say, to put the president under symbolic house arrest and to announce to him and the rest of the American people that we're going to do everything in our power, where we live, where we work, and maybe some other places, to paralyze the war machine, to move from dissent to resistance, and to move from resistance to effective strikes, effective paralyzing and crippling of the war machine so that it can no longer operate. Thank you.
That was David Dellinger. This is WBAI New York.
I just want to say two things. First of all, I wish I could stay for questions or discussion. Because of this hour-long taxi ride that should have been about 20 minutes, I'm now overdue somewhere else, and I hate to be continually late. In fact, it's for a television broadcast. Secondly, I want to say that in considering the chances, if that's the word for it, of what I've been talking about becoming a reality, that is paralyzing the war machine, remembering that nobody, you nor I nor no central committee or decentralized committee can call for it, but it can be there, these can be the right times. Remember the GIs. I predict that if five U.S. senators think that the money should be kept away from the war machine, that there are hundreds of thousands of GIs who think that their labor power, their lives, should not be laid down for the war machine today. Now, now, we don't have control over that, and nobody outside the Army should be so presumptuous as to tell the people inside the Army what they should do. But one thing we can do is to revive the old custom of the Underground Railway for Panthers who want to escape from the attacks of the government and for soldiers who do not want to serve any longer in the U.S. Armed Forces and to commit war crimes and to be part of U.S. aggression. But other than that, let me simply say that I predict that if you're mad and I'm mad and the senators are mad and the students are mad, I mean, I state that the GIs are more mad than we are, and I predict that in one form or another, they're going to find an expression for that. And everything that we do in the way of paralyzing the war machine where we are, I hope will give them confidence and courage in their own way to do whatever they feel that they have to do.
That applause for David Dellinger. This is Bob Kuttner at our studios at 39th Street. The next scheduled speaker is a representative of the Black Panther Party, and we're going to cut back in just a moment to begin that. Let me warn listeners of two possibilities. In the first place, there is a possibility of language which may offend you, and if you think you're not up to taking this language, we suggest you turn to another station. Two stations very much like Pacifica in the past month have been sanctioned by the FCC for alleged obscenity. And we are very anxious to have you listen to these representatives or this representative of the Black Panther Party. All we can say is that if, and we have no guarantee, we have no promise to avoid use of heavy language. If this gets heavy, we're going to have to cut away and bring it to you later on tape. We're cutting now back to the church.
All power to the people.
Power to the people.
I guess everyone that's here this afternoon is gathered to relate specifically to the war in Cambodia. Before I begin to deal with that, and I won't spend too much time dealing in the situation in Cambodia, the war in Cambodia, because I have a more direct problem that black people in America have to relate to, and that's the war that the Nixon, Agnew, and Mitchell clique is waging against the Black Panther Party. You see, so I'm going to deal with that specifically. But I'd like to point out to the people here in the audience that this morning at about 11 o'clock, I received a call from the Harlem branch of the Black Panther Party that more than 40 members of the Jewish Defense League was in front of our office and was about to hold a press conference relating to some alleged anti-Semitic statements that we make in our newspaper or literature that we pass out relating to specifically to anti-Semitism, you see. So we called and we amassed a few Panthers, and the people in the community became very enraged, and they came out there and threw the races out of Harlem, you see. We'd like to point out at this point that the Black Panther Party is not anti-Semitic, you see, because we definitely relate to the Palestine Liberation Front, and a lot of people tend to forget that the Arab people are Semitic people also, you see. And another thing that should be made explicitly clear is that we are not saying that the Jewish people and Israel should be driven into the sea, nor as the spokesman from the Al-Fatah said that, or anyone else in the Arab world. See, what they're saying is that they do not want bandits, you see, who are like members of the Stern Gang, for an example, coming over there, taking their country, and the only right that the rulers of Israel have to that land is a robber's right. And I'm kind of harnessed up here talking to you because we usually don't talk this way in the colony with the four-letter words and et cetera, and I understand that this is a live broadcast and it goes over the air, and people from BAI might lose their license, you see. So I'm at a disadvantage because I don't talk like this all the time. But anyway, after they were thrown out of the community, we went on with our business and dealing, and some of the hustlers, or what Huey P. Newton calls the illegitimate capitalists in the community, they too became uptight, and they got out of their Cadillacs with the velvet tops and the suede bottoms, and they came over and threw the races out of our community. So we just wanted the people to know that. And tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock in the morning, we will be holding a press conference at the Harlem office relating specifically to this fact. I was up in Canada the other day, and I had read news about the students Kent being murdered. And I had made a statement to that at that time saying that it is a clear example that fascism is running amok in America. It is not a question that it's around the corner or it's coming next fall. It is here now. You see, Nixon, in his move to vamp in Cambodia, you see, it's the same thing that he has been doing all across the world. It's the same type of wars of aggression that the United States government has been waging against third world people for some time now, you see. It would be hard for me to speak about that specifically, you see, because everyone knows it, you see, or everyone should know it, about the war machinery that exists in the Pentagon, that it is profitable for the big business or industry in this country to wage war, and that young men, the youth of America, are an expendable item, you see, so why some old, bald-headed racist can become richer and richer while the youth of this country dies, you see, under the name or under the pretext of spreading the democracy for the world. And that's a bunch of jive. We know that to be that. When I said earlier that I have to deal specifically with the war that the racists in Washington are waging against the Black Panther Party, you see, because last Friday, on May the 1st, when we had a rally in New Haven, Connecticut, for Chairman Bobby Seale of the Black Panther Party and nine other Panthers in New Haven, the news media, which is an arm of the fascist government, for a whole week had tried to vilify our rally and more or less give the rally an aura of violence. And they perpetrated this for more than 2 weeks. When that fool up there, I think his name was Governor Dempsey, He got in on the box and called to Washington and talked to the other fool, Mitchell, and said that they needed paratroopers and Marines and 30,000 National Guards there for a peaceful demonstration. Now, the leadership of the Black Panther Party had stated very explicitly that the rally, for all intentions, was intended to be peaceful, you know. But they went out and said, no, Panthers do not do nothing peaceful, and they needed all these National Guards troops. But what they were trying to do was to sow the support that was being formulated around the defense of the Black Panther Party and the chairman and the Panthers in New Haven in particular.
This is Zaid Shakur of the Black Panther Party.
The Panthers in the electric chair. They intend to murder Bobby Seale in the electric chair in New Haven. And we have a saying now in our party that we say that if Bobby Seale is electrocuted in the electric chair, then we're going to cut off the juice in all America. And our Minister of Information, Eldridge Cleaver, 2 months ago delivered a press release which has come to be known now as the Black Panther Party Manifesto. You see, that relates specifically to this. And he says that it basically deals with the fact that we in the Black Panther Party, since the inception of our party, have always been relating to a class struggle. You see, we have always put the concept of a class struggle here in America, and that we have seen very little results of it, you know, in terms of our allies in the mother country. The premise of this relationship, the solidarity between the Black Panther Party and white organizations, was that there would be revolution or class struggle in the mother country, and it would be national liberation in the colony. And we haven't seen too much of this. We have seen when our chairman was gagged and bound in the courtroom of Chicago, there was only a little murmur in the streets, you see. But when the conspiracy ate, originally it was eight, and some people tend to forget, when they were found in contempt, then all the students and young white people were out in the street, you see, and we recognize this as being racism, you see. I relate, and I feel very bad about the fact that the four students at Kent were murdered, you see, and I look around and I see there are general strikes going on upon thousands of universities throughout America, the United States, you see. But when our deputy chairman, Fred Hampton in Chicago, was murdered in his sleep, and Mark Clark in Chicago in December, you see, again, there was only a murmur, you see. So we see this as blatant racism again, you see. So we don't have the time to sit around and keep, you know, perpetrating the idea of a class struggle at the risk of committing suicide. You see, we don't have the time. We know that the FBI and Mitchell and Hoover are in the process of annihilating our party. Last Friday, they vamped on the Baltimore office of the Black Panther Party for the alleged torture murder of someone down there. The murder was committed, according to the papers, last July the 12th. The body was not found until October. Now, all this time, the pigs in Baltimore knew nothing about the murder, the particulars pertaining to the murder, until the day before the rally in New Haven on May Day, when they received information from the FBI implicating the Panthers. You see, so we say that the pigs are trying to set up another New Haven situation where they can use this as a pretext to kick down our doors in search of a so-called fugitive. And the only Panther mentioned on the indictment, which included 18 people, was the field marshal of the Black Panther Party, Don Cox, you see. Now, we know last summer what they did when they went across the country from Denver to Chicago to New York to New Haven and kicked down the doors of our offices and our homes, you see. So we don't have time to sit around and play games and try to convince people that the United States government is out to commit genocide against them. We really don't have the time, you see. So I hope people here can understand that. You see, and we're saying at this late date in the game that we will cut loose a racial holocaust in America, that America will not survive. You see, we must relate to where our power lies at. Black people do not have economic power, they do not have military power, and they do not have land or feudal power. And the only power that we have is the power to disrupt, or as Eldridge Cleaver would say, the power to throw a nigger wrench into the machinery, you see. And this is what we will have to resort to, and this is what we intend to resort to, you see. Now, so what we are saying is that it's time to either stop all the talk and relate to little action. We don't need no more theoreticians. We need more practitioners, you see. And if we know America needs our class struggle, you see, and we also know that America cannot survive a race war, you see. So it's up to the youth of America, because it's the youth that makes the revolution. And I'm going to have to split, because I've been waiting around here too long to talk anyway. And I'm going back up to the colony and do some organizing up there among black people. And I'm going to say all power to the people.
Sage Shakur, Minister of Information of the New York Black Panther Party.
We're going to have to modify the format somewhat because it's getting late. Both of the next two speakers, who both have important things to say, both have other places to go. So we're going to move along quickly. The next speaker is going to be Adam Walensky, and after him, Andy Stapp of the American Servicemen's Union. Adam Walensky, a former staff member to the late Senator Robert F. Kennedy, and now working with the New York Moratorium Committee. Adam Walensky.
I feel very out of place in a pulpit. I thought I'd read you something. I need to start with, if that's okay. It's a UPI dispatch, which was printed on the editorial page of the Washington Post as an editorial. And I just, a couple of things in it. It's about a town called, I don't even know how to pronounce it, called Snul in Cambodia. And that American tanks, it said, to smash through the smoldering ruins of this rubber plantation town leveled by massive airstrikes. Their crews looted what remained. And that the U.S. tankers had met heavy resistance from guerrilla defenders at the edge of the town Tuesday afternoon. They fired 90 millimeter guns into the buildings, and warplanes finished the job with bombs and napalm, and thus did Snul become the first Cambodian town of significant size to be destroyed by American arms. It goes on to point out that as they passed the leveled shops, the GIs helped themselves to beer, cases of soft drinks, mirrors, suitcases, shoes, clothes, and even a motorcycle they strapped onto a tank. One shed standing after the airstrikes was set afire after tankers looted it of small items, including cases of flashlight batteries. Specialist for Ronald Brown of Detroit, Michigan, shook his head when he saw the body of a child that apparently had been killed by a napalm strike. There was, at one shop, a GI spotted a display of sunglasses. "Hey man," yelled another, "grab them shades." Several GIs helped themselves to the glasses. One tossed a suitcase of shoes onto the tank. I think that that reminds us, and the proper tone for the remark, as we look at what is happening in our own country and what is happening in Vietnam and Cambodia, that in precisely the sense that Judge Julius Hoffman May, as he was described by some of his defendants, as that he may be the greatest yippie of them all, so it is certainly true that the greatest anarchists, I believe, since Prince Kropotkin himself, are Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew.